You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. We're going to move ahead and actually move out into space because up next, the neighborhood around Pluto is getting crowded, or actually we're discovering how crowded it really is. We didn't do anything to make more crowded. That's because the Hubble Space Telescope has found two new moons around the distant planet, bringing the total to three. A camera on the telescope got photo proof of the moons, which are creatively labeled P1 and P2. Took those pictures in May, and the official announcement came last week in the journal Nature. Richard Binzel is professor of planetary sciences and the chair of the program in planetary science at MIT in Cambridge. He joins us now to talk about the new moons and a spacecraft on its way to Pluto. He is on the phone from his office in Cambridge. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Binzel.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
Those were great. I saw the photos on the web. That was a great photo of those moons of Pluto.
Yeah, they're quite astounding. It's a matter of just getting the time and being able to search carefully, and it's always amazing what you find.
Why has it taken us so long to find them?
Well, there have been searches for the satellites of Pluto from the ground for many years, in fact, going all the way back to its discovery in 1930. And it's just a matter of getting better and better instruments and better looks. And finally, we got the time on the Hubble, and we were able to look in close and carefully at the region around Pluto, and there they were. We call them P1 and P2.
And what might they someday be called?
Who
names them?
Yes. So these names, P1 and P2, are just their preliminary names. They will get official names from the International Astronomical Union, a governing body of astronomers, and those names might come out this summer.
Mm-hmm. Give us an idea of the size of those two new moons compared to the one we know about.
Well, Charon is about 1,200 kilometers or about 1,000 miles. Pluto is about 1,000 miles across, and Charon's about half that.
Mm-hmm.
These little guys, P1 and P2, may be about 50 miles across.
50?
Yeah.
No wonder it took a while to find them.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, the debate about a moon, even our own moon, we debated for years how the moon was formed. How do we think these two moons were formed?
Well, what's interesting about Pluto's large moon, Charon, and these two smaller ones that we call P1 and P2 is that they're all in the same plane. So it's like the same tabletop, if you will. You could make a tabletop or a plane through the orbits of all of these satellites. And that's probably a clue as to how they formed. You know, it's always been a problem figuring out how the Earth's moon formed. And the best idea we have is that right after the Earth was forming a large body, maybe even the size of Mars, crashed into Earth and splashed a lot of material off of the Earth that formed the moon. And we're thinking that's the same way that Pluto got its large moon Charon, that some large body left over from the early formation of the solar system smashed into Pluto and splashed some material off, and we got Charon. Mm-hmm. And because these other satellites are in the same plane or the same tabletop, orbit plane as Charon, we think that maybe they formed at the same time. That was just an additional material that also formed independent moons at the same time the big moon was formed.
Mm-hmm. Might there be other undiscovered moons around Pluto?
Well, it's possible that these guys, P1 and P2, are just the tip of the iceberg because one can always probe faster, deeper, and farther. And the fact that there's these two small guys, I think, suggests that there could be more. We certainly haven't finished looking yet.
And why would Pluto have so many little moons? Why would it be its own little solar system there?
The neat thing about Pluto is that it's so far from the sun that sort of the gravitational perturbations or tweaks or torques that you might get from the sun itself or from Jupiter, it's a little bit more independent, and so it's possible that Pluto can have a little bit more complicated system that we might not otherwise see in close to the sun.
Mm-hmm. Now, there is a space probe headed on its way to Pluto, correct?
That's right. We have a mission called New Horizons. It was launched from Florida last January 19th, and we are on our way to Pluto. It's a 9-year flight to get from Earth to Pluto, even though we're currently traveling 20 miles a second. We're going so fast. At that speed, it would take you 10 seconds to go from New York to Washington. But still, even at that kind of velocity, it's going to take us 9 years to get all the way out to Pluto.
1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK, if you want to dial it that way. Talking with Richard Binzel, professor of planetary sciences and the chair of the program in planetary science at MIT. Do you want to, I'm going to approach this gingerly, Dr. Binzel, about this whole debate about Pluto, because a lot of people think, oh, this is just something that, you know, is trivial. I mean, does the fact that Pluto has two more moons that we know about make it any less trivial, or add to the fact that maybe we should put it in the camp of being a planet, or does it not matter?
Well, first of all, I think the moons make Pluto an even more interesting place than it was before. It's telling us that there's a lot of interesting things going around in the whole Pluto system. So I think Pluto's just gotten a lot more exciting and interesting, and I've always thought it was interesting in the first place. The second thing is Pluto doesn't care what we call it. Pluto's an interesting place no matter what we call it. It's a body that has an atmosphere. It has these moons. We believe it has polar caps. We believe it has seasons. In fact, all of the science questions that we're addressing with our spacecraft mission called New Horizons, all of the science we're doing on Pluto and the scientific questions we're asking are the same kinds of scientific questions we ask about missions that go to Mars, for example. So they're planet questions, and it's planet science, regardless of what you call Pluto.
Speaking of planet science, are you fearful that the budget cuts at NASA, which are happening to the space science programs, because of the money that is being funneled toward returning to the moon and Mars and the space station, are you fearful for those other science projects?
Well, it's always a question of balance, and in my view, the robotic program of NASA has been an outstanding success in terms of the science and the excitement per dollar that comes back. Now, that's not to say that we don't need visions in other areas, but I think that one has to make sure that the overall program remains in balance. And I think what's currently proposed, my personal opinion, is that is tweaking the whole system out of balance.
Mm-hmm. Because the jewel, you know, right now the jewels of the system are the planetary probes and the Hubbles and things like that.
That's right, and it's all about the vision and exploration, you have to imagine that the robotic and the human spaceflight program go hand in hand, that the robotic program leads the way and the human program can eventually follow. And so we've got to have this be a partnership, a thing that moves forward together, and not be in a situation where we're trying to do one at the expense of the other. This should all move together in a very smooth, uniform way.
Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in here. Kenneth in Cottonwood, Arizona. Hi, Kenneth.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
And thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Hi, Kenneth. What can I do for you?
Wanted to talk to you about naming these two moons of Pluto.
Okay.
I've sent in a few emails to the IAU, but I haven't had any success in getting a return from
them.
Okay.
Well, keep sending, or I'm sure they've been received, and the prerogative for the name goes to the discoverers. And, the way it works is the discoverers get to choose what names they would like to propose, and the IAU is the body that makes the decision. So, it's a process, and I'm sure that getting suggestions into the system are welcome. But it's the discoverers who will make the formal suggestions or the formal proposals to the IAU, and the IAU will be making its decision. And it can choose what the discoverers propose, or it can choose whatever they deem is appropriate.
Kenneth, can you share with us what names you proposed?
Yes. The two names I was proposing were Tartarus and Erebus. And those two are the sections of the underworld in Greek mythology. And since Pluto is already named after Hades and all that, and Charon, the boatman on the River Styx, I thought that would be, well, for them, because it's just the two there.
A natural fit.
Yes, those are great suggestions.
And all right, Kenneth.
You're definitely up on your mythology.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having a good weekend. Do we know what the names that the discoverers propose for these?
No, they have not divulged what they're thinking.
So we might actually have a winner here.
I don't know.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Ed in Berkeley. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Boy, I am so impressed by your last caller. My gosh. Anyway, I don't want to forget
that. You've got a tough phone call to follow, Ed.
Indeed. But I may have succeeded. Can the moons have moons? I mean, I know they probably don't, but what governs that? How many generations can it go? If our solar, could our solar system go around a hugely big sun? I know it goes around the center of the Milky Way, but how many, you know, if there's the center of the Milky Way, then there's our sun, then it's us, then it's a moon. Could that moon have a moon?
Right. Well, it's very interesting. Maybe the most well-known analogy are multiple star systems, where you can have a primary star and then a secondary star, where the second one is actually double. And so you can get these multiple systems. It's probably difficult in the case of Pluto and Charon because what you need is have the system be stable against gravitational tugs or perturbations from other things. And so the fact that Charon is so large, it probably would disturb anything in orbit around P1 and P2. And in fact, even Charon, I think, even is responsible for placing P1 and P2 where they are, because P1, for example, is in an orbit that goes around exactly one time for every six times that Charon goes around. P2 is in an orbit that goes around one time for exactly every four times that Charon goes around.
Wow.
Charon's closer in, so it goes faster. And these are little ratios are called resonances.
Wow.
So it may even be that Charon is driving was even driving the formation, or at least maybe nudging these orbits so that when they finally got to these perfect resonance locations that they stayed still and stopped and have been able to travel since. So,
Ed, I hope we made your day.
Well, that is beautiful, and the fact that there's these resonances, that is just amazing. On what basis would it be? How many generations? Like five generations, or could you have 20 generations? I mean, how do you do the? It's the mass of each objects.
Yeah, you just have to look and see whose gravity dominates and whether something can be stable against all the nudges and tweaks and pulls or perturbations that other things can pull on you. And it is indeed a complicated problem, but I think in the case of P1 and P2, they're probably there as solo bodies in the system.
We're talking about Pluto this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. With Richard Binzel, it reminds me of that old three-body problem in math and physics.
That's right.
made my hair hurt.
And once you get more than three bodies in the universe, it gets much more complicated. And in the case of the Pluto system, we've got four.
Oh, boy. Let's see if we can get a quick last phone call in from Sandy in Massachusetts. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, Professor. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about Pluto itself and whether it has an atmosphere or not.
Well, Pluto, we think, has an atmosphere of nitrogen and maybe methane. And, and it's interesting. Pluto was just closest to the sun in 1989. It reached its closest point called perihelion. And now it's another century, Pluto will be at its farthest point. And we think when Pluto warms up, that the ices on its surface go into the gas phase, and we get this thin atmosphere. So we have, in fact, detected an atmosphere around Pluto. We know it's there. And a big question we have that we're hoping to find out when New Horizons gets there in 2015 is whether the atmosphere is still present or whether it is frozen entirely out onto the surface.
We can always hope there's still intelligent life on this planet by the time it gets there 9 years from now. Will New Horizons be taking measurements of the solar system as it goes, or does it shut down and wait till it gets to Pluto?
Well, in just about a year, in fact, just under a year from now, we will be arriving at Jupiter, and we're going to use Jupiter as a gravitational boost or gravitational assist to get us out to Pluto in a little bit faster fashion. And we're going to take science data on Jupiter during our flyby. And then after Jupiter, we're going to go into more or less a quiet phase for the spacecraft. We'll have routine checkouts of the spacecraft to make sure it's happy and healthy. But we'll go into a quiet phase so that we've got everything functioning up with, you know, at full full capacity or full capability when we get to our main target, which is, of course, the Pluto system.
And what, and in the last minute I have left, what is the thing you want to know most about Pluto? It has to be answered.
Yep. I think we want to know what it's made of and how it's there. It's an entirely different region of the solar system, and the ices and all of the material that Pluto is made up of Pluto is the basic building blocks of what formed all of the planets, including the Earth, and even the very stuff of life. It's all preserved out there in the outer solar system, and we just want to go out and see what it is firsthand.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us, and good luck to you. We'll be following that mission, I hope, on Science Friday for the next 9 years.
All right. Call us anytime.
Take care. Richard Binzel is professor of planetary sciences, the Margaret McVicar Faculty Fellow and chair of the Department of Planetary Science at MIT in Cambridge. Kimberly Jones is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Neil Roush, Manoli Weatherell, and Manya Zuba in New York, Casey Parkin in Washington. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help from NPR librarian Mary Glendinning. If you have comments or questions, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can leave us email there. You can download a podcast. You can also click on the button on the left where it says For Teachers. We give out free teaching curricula based on Science Friday. I'm sure everybody could use some free teaching science curricula. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.